This is Stuart Moxham of The Gist, and you are listening to 90.7 FM WGXC Acra.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, heard weekday mornings here at 8 o'clock on WGXC 90.7 FM. WGXC is hosting its pledge drive, and we need your support. Help keep hands-on creative community radio alive in your region by calling 518-697-7400. That's 518-697-7400. Or you can pledge online with your tax-deductible pledge at wgxc.org/donate. That's wgxc.org/donate. Help WGXC meet its goal and keep local, national, and international news broadcasting in Greene and Columbia counties. Thanks so much. Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, heard weekday mornings here at 8 o'clock on WGXC 90.7 FM. WGXC is hosting its pledge drive, and we need your support. Help keep hands-on creative community radio alive in your region by calling 518-697-7400. That's 518-697-7400. Or you can pledge online with your tax-deductible pledge at wgxc.org/donate. That's wgxc.org/donate. Help WGXC meet its goal and keep local, national, and international news broadcasting in Greene and Columbia counties. Thanks so much.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the First Presbyterian Church of Hudson, a faith community open to all. Whether you are single, married, divorced, gay, wealthy, poor, or no habla inglés, if you are just browsing, just woke up, or just got out of jail, it doesn't matter if you work on Wall Street or if you sleep on Wall Street, you belong. We love soccer moms, crying babies, vegans, hipsters, seekers and doubters, tourists and locals. All are welcome. Services held Sunday mornings at 10:45 a.m. You can find us on the web at firstpreshudson.org.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Amanda Lees of Freehold, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
Good evening. I'm Kevin Factor, and this is Foraging Ahead. Tonight, I have a conversation with VFW Post 7765 Commander in Red Hook, New York, Brian Williams, who is a veteran of Desert Shield and Desert Storm, as well as the NYPD. And also joining us is U.S. Army Major Warren Shepru, who served in the Marine Corps from 1987 to 1995 and was honorably discharged with the rank of corporal, infantry soldier, scout sniper, and then he rejoined the Army in 1999 and he served up till now. He's still serving as a physician assistant with two combat deployments to the Middle East, and he was mobilized in New York State for humanitarian missions in support of 9/11 and Hurricane Sandy. And we all had a conversation at the home of Jeremy Davidson, who was writer, an actor, and is involved in Story Horse Theater. He is the his wife directs Mary Stuart Masterson, and this conversation centers around Jeremy's new production called Rancid, which is about a local family's journey with PTSD, and it's got two-time Tony Award winner Norbert Leo Butz in the titular role of Rancich. And that'll be in Tivoli at Murray's from November 8th to November 10th. And it's a benefit for the Red Hook VFW Post 7765. You can get tickets at storyhorse.org. We're going to discuss life in and out of the military, the VFW, NYPD. These are American voices that many people don't get an opportunity to hear. We live in our little bubbles, and the country seems to be a bit divided these days, and it's just good to listen with open ears and open minds. The topics, in addition to Jeremy's work with Story Horse, ideas like character, and service, and sacrifice, and community, and duty come up. This is a pledge drive, so we can hear all of these voices on WGXC, Community Radio for Open Ears. Please, if you get a chance, call in and support local radio.
And that's been really healthy for me at this point in my life. And we rely on each other. And you can pretend that's not the case in a big city, maybe, and disappear into yourself and your echo chambers. But like, this community is full of veterans. This community is full of people who serve in all kinds of ways. And you know, this project, I hope it keeps going, but it makes sense. It made sense. And Brian started introducing me to some people, and that's how it came about.
I want to add something else about Jeremy, because I think it's speaks to character. About community, when we do have the events, and normally I'm speaking at the Memorial Park, mm-hmm. at some role. Warren is usually there. Jeremy, without being asked, probably doesn't even necessarily want it this heard, but Jeremy and his family, Mary Stewart, have been at the Memorial Park for Veterans Day or for Memorial Day. And spontaneously, he's there picking up chairs, helping us load them up, put them in, get everything shipped back to the post. I can't think of another civilian that does this. I'm not saying people aren't standing there and willing to help, but he actually pitches in with that unsolicited. It's a pretty big deal to me.
You know, me picking up chairs is not that big of a deal.
It is.
Straight about that,
but it is. But it really, really is. Jeremy.
But I just wanted to say, like, it's kind of, you say that, but you know, we're all a work in progress. Our community is always going to be a work in progress. We're all, but when people are service minded people, boy, is that special. You know, I think looking for, there are other organizations in the community that are working to try to find ways to help veterans continue being of service in the world, in our world. But, you know, it's, anyway, we live in a place where it's necessary to remind each other who is here, who, what we have relied upon, the sacrifices people have made so that we can have the way of life we do. And so, you know, that's what we're trying to do with this story. I think, you know, the Rancich family, Brian introduced me to Tom Rancich when Tom was here for Memorial Day, I guess a year and a half ago now. And there have been other people stories that I've collected along the way through Brian and just through my own meeting people, but there comes a point where sometimes when I collect a story, I'm like, I don't know how to tell this person's story yet. And it's frustrating when that happens because people's stories are, you know, there's family, you know, it's gone through a lot. There's another military family I've interviewed and they've gone through a lot. I just haven't been able to figure out how to tell it properly.
Hmm.
And so, when I met Tom, when Brian introduced me to Tom, I left that, we sat down for maybe, I don't know, 3.5-4 hours when mm-hmm. he was here and his, with his sister, Sandy. And I left that meeting immediately. I was like, I know this, I know I can tell this story. I knew it because, not because of anything I do, it's just Tom's story has magic in it. And they have a lot of love in that family.
Mm.
And that's worth talking about. That's worth sharing. Stories that have that's a useful story to tell, particularly at this time. A story that is filled with a certain will to survive. That is, it's not easy, but I think it's a good thing to examine right now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, something that I don't know how to articulate this, but to get back to what you said about veterans in the community, so many and the sacrifice they've made. If you could pull this out into a picture, and a great, you know, the latest TV there is out there, Tom's story is an incredible story, but it's just one pixel mm-hmm. in a big screen of veterans making up each pixel. There's just so much out there. Tom just happens to be that person that when he walks into the room, Tom is the only one in the room of 100. He is the guy. And as I think Jeremy said, I said something along, he is the real deal. And you get that feeling. That undercurrent is behind everything. There are people out there that sort of inflate themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Tom is not one. I think whatever he presents, you're getting just a small fraction of what he's experienced. And you feel that Tom is somebody that you can feel the weight of what he carries to this day. When he speaks to you, if he could be talking about something in the yard, you can just feel like there's a lot going on in that man's mind.
Mm.
Incredible man. Mm. Wait, we are a valuable organization. We really are two veterans that need us. To most everybody, we're just the VFW post. But to the people in need, we are somebody could call today with a problem, whether it be a veteran of foreign war or not, just a veteran. And we are there. And we're there for the family members as well.
Mm.
So, yeah, we bring a lot to the table. But to the function of the VFW, that's one of the reasons I brought Warren along.
Mm.
And I might add, we talk about Tom Rancich. Warren, as a physician assistant, can tell you, and he tells you, you know, I won't go too deep into it because it's very emotional for him, but of people that he's lost on the operating table. And he can recite the minute, the day, the every bit of the event. Warren's another one of the... is a Tom Rancich. Not quite a Navy SEAL.
Not even close.
But he is. In that your stories. In the sacrifice. Because this is an emotional toll.
Unquestionably. And there's, it sticks with you for the rest of your life. I mean, I can tell you the numbers of, I had a very unique job when I was in Iraq for a year, in that I was a detachment commander of a small medical company, and I was a mortuary affairs officer, and I was all these things in one person. And so I got to see the worst that humanity has to offer to humanity. And every one of those people that, whether I examined them as a mortuary affairs officer or as a provider trying to save their lives, I remember every one of them. Every single one. There's without missing one. I mean, I may not know all their names, but I remember every exam I did. I remember every patient I lost. I remember every soldier that came in through my clinic that I treated. It's unbelievable how, I mean, I can't remember what I had for breakfast yesterday.
Right.
But when I was, you know, 13 years ago, I remember Sergeant X that came in. I remember the shrapnel I pulled out of him. I remember seeing him in the hospital at Northern Dutchess because I replaced his mother's knee and he walked through the door and I had no idea they were related. And he was like, "Doc." And I, to this day, I, you know, it was amazing. And then his mother was like, "You took care of my dad." So it's like the whole thing.
Oh my God.
Yeah. It was surreal. I had no idea. I did not make the connection whatsoever.
Do you remember how many years or how long after? I mean,
probably 3 or 4 wow. years later.
Oh.
And as soon as I saw him, I knew who he was. He knew exactly who I was. And we were back into our regular lives again. You know, he had gotten out of the Army. I'm still in the Army as a, you know, and I'm still friends with him. I'm still friends with his mom and his father. His father's a lacrosse referee, actually. And yeah, so it's really has come full circle, and it's kind of a very
harder small to yell at now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Were your kids? So were they quite young?
Lucas was 4. Max was. This was 2006. Max was 2.5.
Mm.
We So that, talk about like pulling your heart out. I had been gone for 1.5 years. So when I came back, my kids didn't know who I was.
Mm.
They wouldn't come to me as their father.
Mm.
It took about 4 months for my youngest son to come to me and call me dad. And, you know, and it's just a matter of it. Every night it was, you know, it crushes you. This is your son, you know.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, and for him not to know who you are, you know. Now he probably wishes he didn't know who I was.
He's a teenager.
It's good. Yeah. You got your job.
Yeah, but exactly. But that really was, that's, you know, as we all live with, all of us who are veterans who separate from our family at some point, live with, you know, the cost of war on the other side of the ocean. There's a big cost to pay at home also. And I'm sure you got into some of that with your interview with Tom and his family.
Yeah, it is the thing about the families that, and I, this is another reason I thought after meeting Tom that it was possible to do this one, is because the family opened up to me as well, and what they shared is so relatable to anybody. What military families go through, and I don't want to generalize, but it's important to remember that it's not just the soldier. And so, you know, I don't know. I imagine, you know, your wife, it's just a enormous lift.
Mm. We always say as deployed soldiers, we have it easier than our families at home.
Yeah.
Cause when we leave but as soon as you leave, you start developing a new family.
Yeah.
And that bond, you know, you're going through experiences with those people. That nobody can understand. Not nobody, but most people can't understand. And you become so ensconced in, you know everything about them, from their kids to their wives to their fathers and mothers. You become family overseas. And so it's much harder for our families back home to deal with us not being there than it is for us not being with them, because we have now developed second family. And it's really, to this day, I keep in contact with the guys and girls that I went downrange with, mm-hmm. Almost on a daily basis. And we'll commiserate together. We'll be, you know, on dates on June 26th every year. I know who I'm calling because I know what happened on that day in 2007. I think it transcends generations as well. Mm-hmm. Like Brian said, I'm a physician assistant. I do orthopedic surgery here in Rhinebeck, one town south, two towns south of us. And I will get veterans all the time. And I always thank them for the service. And when nobody's around, I'll go back in the room and I'll start talking to them.
Mm.
And this is a 92-year-old guy who landed at Normandy on Omaha Beach, you know, and or a Marine who did the island hopping at Tarawa, Iwo Jima, Okinawa, you know, the island hopping campaign in the Marine Corps in World War II. And these guys, it's like a wall comes right down and there's an instant bond, which I've found fantastic, because these guys are guys that will not open up with other people who haven't experienced very similar. And what I did in the Middle East is nothing compared to what these guys did during World War II. They left and never knew when they were coming home.
I think the VFW, if I'm done, even when I was younger, you could go into the post Friday, Saturday, Sunday. It was standing room only. It was packed. it was the place to be. And I think that that was pretty much the case after World War II. The VFW was community central. And probably everywhere in America was community central.
Well, it was different because everybody participated in, in that.
Even the wives. Everybody. Even everybody was part of the war effort. You were fined if you had metal in your backyard or tires that you did not give to the cause.
Yeah.
It was a true, you know, there was a we might lose mentality. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, it's more like a video game. Yeah, it's over there. We're not really part of. We're not invested in, as a community.
Well, not even invested. I think a lot of people aren't even aware that we are still engaged.
Real,
in
like honest to God, real as your mother. Real mothers are losing their kids every day.
Yeah,
that's huge. That's huge, and it's not even a. When I was a kid, I'm old enough to say. Vietnam, I remember enough about Vietnam. I was young, but I remember the names scrolling by onto every day. The names would scroll by. That doesn't happen today. It's just the sacrifice is sort of lost. It's sort of like that's over there. It doesn't really hit home until it hits home.
Do you think
home.
That's by design?
What's that?
Do you think that might be by design?
I don't know.
It's lack of investment.
How do you mean?
So we did an event. Max Brooks spoke to this, this very thing at our event, and he said, you know, and alluding to what Brian was saying about World War II, there was the bond effort. People had a vested interest in this whole thing. That's gone. It's because, like Brian said, it's happening over there. It doesn't affect me here. I mean, college now, it doesn't. What they're doing over there doesn't affect me here. Whereas back then it did, and communities and. Everybody knew somebody who was overseas, and
but in terms of how a democracy functions, how this country functions, if we do divorce ourselves from the people who serve, right, in an all volunteer army, if 98.7% of the people just go to college, go to work, there's a war going on. There's no name scrolling by. It's not in our faces. If it did affect people, do you think it would change how we actually operated in the world? That this actually gives us the ability to.
You mean if there was a
if there was a draft, or if the names were scrolling by, or if there was more attention being paid, then maybe.
If there was a draft,
if
there was social service, yes. If every family, whether you wanted to or not, had to be part of the effort, it would make a tremendous change.
Now you're invested.
That's one of the great things in the military. You walk into a situation, and the person next to you, you've never met somebody from Mississippi.
Never.
You know.
And by the way, if you're from New York, you're from the city instantly. There is no other part of New York other than Manhattan.
Right.
They ask you if you've gotten mugged, if you're going to mug somebody else.
When the reality is, upstate New York is much closer to the South than it is to New York City.
100%.
It is unbelievable how, in the Marine Corps, when you, and Warren betrayed my Corps. He left. He was a Marine.
I did 8 years in the Marine Corps. I was honorably discharged, and I got my education, and then I joined the Army.
Wow.
I've been out for 20 years. There's a reason
behind
that.
Not a good story.
It's a great story.
Oh, yeah. I can't wait to hear that.
So when you show up in boot camp, and your senior drill instructor is finally yelling at you, he tries to be a little bit more fatherly, so he's not yelling as much as the three drill instructors in the room. But when he gives you the welcome aboard speech, in Warren's case, I'm sure, Paris Island for me, he tells you there are no white Marines, there are no black Marines. There is light green and dark green Marines. That's it. And that is pretty much it for where you're from, too. It doesn't matter. None of that matters. It's not... You're all one. That you get there. When they're screaming at you, nobody's dividing themselves by color, or you're just running. You're all running the same direction trying to get away. You're just people. And that's what you are in boot camp immediately. And to different communities. Mm-hmm. California, Texas. And when you're in high school, you're just out of high school in Red Hook, New York. You literally have never met somebody from Mississippi. Mm-hmm. You just haven't. And boom, you're immediately, they're in the rack with you. You know, you're up, they're down, whatever the case may be. You're all there. You're all a team. And that is truly the military even after.
100%.
And I have to say, to your point, Jeremy, I couldn't agree more that society should be invested. But I will say for myself, if I had gone into the Marine Corps and spent my entire time stateside, it happened at the last minute for me. Mm-hmm. My last 6 months in the Marine Corps, I'd got an early out. There is such a thing as an early out. My MOS, my job had gone away. So they didn't have a job for me. So they put me in intelligence. They offered me to switch to another aircraft. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to go to college. Mm-hmm. So I had an early out for education. Well, he'll remember from his days in the Marine Corps. I'm sure the Army has the same thing. But I was home burning up leave. And I called the intelligence office that I was part of. And there was a staff sergeant there. And he said, "Hey, buddy." Normally, I could not talk to staff NCOs, but this guy and I had actually gone bow hunting together mm-hmm. out there. He was the only staff NCO I ever was on. Not a first name basis. I still won't call. We have a sergeant major in our command in the VFW. I call him sergeant major. He's a sergeant major. But this guy, his name was Sam Spade. I remember, staff sergeant, Sam Spade. So he got on the phone. He said, "Hey, I hope you have a pair of flippers." And I said, "No." I knew there were two squadrons going overseas that I was not part of, but I was air wing. I worked on the computers on board attack aircraft. But my plane was gone. My model plane was gone. And I said, "No." Because I knew what he was talking about. He said, "Yep." I said, "No, it's not. I can't. I've got my early out signed by the commandant of the Marine Corps. It had gone through channels. Mm. All the channels." He goes, "Needs of the Marine Corps, buddy. You're going." I spent the next 3-4 days. I called whatever congressman at the time. I'm not going. Nobody would even return my calls.
Right, right.
So I literally flew back to Arizona early to arrive, I think the day before. I think I arrived in the morning the day before. I moved my car to a parking lot that they had given us to park. And found myself waiting to fly to Alaska, waiting to fly to Japan. Point is, when I was in those countries, Philippines, Korea, I am so glad I was not successful, because I never would have realized what this country was and what it meant until I saw the way people live in so many other countries. Mm-hmm. Not what you see on TV, mm-hmm. not when somebody's filming in Bangkok,
right.
But when you go a mile outside of Bangkok mm-hmm. and you see people with chickens walking in and out of the house, you can understand, not that you would do it here,
but
you can understand how families sell their daughters into prostitution.
Mm.
100%. Because she can make more in one day than the father can make a half mile out in a year. Mm. That is the world. That's the world. It's not the world we know. We're sort of spoiled here. After Vietnam, they wouldn't let Vietnam veterans join.
Really?
Yeah. That was part of the BS of the VFW. What? They didn't consider it a war, essentially.
But what about
they were not as worthy.
But that was the national office, the national organization?
They were not in. They weren't allowed in.
I tell you, so when I was in the Marine Corps, and the first Gulf War in 1991, I was in for that, and I was in the infantry, I was a young man, and then I was eventually a scout sniper, so I was a trigger puller from a long distance, and we were out of Camp Pendleton, California. We were coming to battalion strength to get ready to go over to Iraq. And we were literally on the tarmac getting ready to fly overseas, getting ready to load the plane, and they stood us down because it was only a 100-hour war, so it all ended, but they didn't need any more soldiers. Marines,
excuse me.
Correct. Marines, I stand corrected. 100%, I stand corrected. They didn't need any more Marines.
What's the difference?
Well, I'll explain this.
Yeah. He's looking at me like I'm an idiot.
So, no. I should probably do push-ups for that one, actually.
Explain to us.
So when we came back, we came back and we landed at LaGuardia, I think. And as we're coming off the plane on the tarmac, the first people to greet us off that plane were Vietnam vets. To a man, probably 40 of them. And it's every one of them, almost everyone with a tear in their eye, and thanked everyone. And I was like, how did you guys, what happened? And they said, every single one of them said that we are never, ever going to let happen to you guys what happened to us when we got off our planes. Never, ever going to let you guys not be involved in the VFW or an organization to support the military or anything like that. And these are guys who were spit on and yelled at and not allowed in an organization that supports veterans of foreign wars. So the heart that they showed and the intestinal fortitude that they showed to come out of that tarmac
and they still do. Welcome back. They are still the backbone. That's one of our problems as an organization. If you remove our Vietnam veterans right now, we have no backbone. We are nothing. We are just a useless heap on the floor.
So what about the veterans who are coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria?
It's tough to get them involved.
Is it?
I think for a while I was the youngest veteran in the post.
So you may have been. I'm not sure. What I can tell you is, for me, I would think. I don't know if Warren had the same experience, but when I was in, I did 4 years active, then I got out, and then I got activated again for Desert Storm. So I was in what they call the inactive ready reserve. I think it's a 4 year. Is it a 4 year obligation?
Depending on, it's an 8 year commitment totally if you do four and four or six.
So I did 4 years active, and then you have to once a year go out. I think for me it was Groton, Connecticut. Go out to the sub base, and I would have a physical there once a year, and it allows the military to know that should the need arise, I'm of standards, that they can call me back in out of the civilian world. So it's an 8 year obligation. So most people get out before, they never hear from the Marine Corps or the military again. In my case, I was in peacetime. And when I went in the Marine Corps, I thought I would be carrying a knife in my teeth, like in the trenches. And I ended up doing one of the, getting the most schooling the Marine Corps had to offer. They would never let me touch a knife. I had to qualify with a rifle every year, twice a year, whatever it was. And I was on the Marine Corps rifle team. But other than that, there was no real Marine Corps, like what I pictured in the jungles type Marine. So I was chomping at the bit when they called me to go back in for Iraq. I was like, this is what we were about. This is what we're supposed to be. Anyhow, I did that inactive ready reserve, got called back in after. For a while, in my mind, probably in some ways I still feel this way many years later, I'm still in the inactive ready reserve. If they really had to call me, if they had needed everybody, and they just need somebody to shave their hair, lose some weight, and go work in supply, I would go. I would go do it. So there was a time period when I got out, when I would look at, first off, when you're a kid, right? When I got out, I was probably 21, the first time, 21 years old. Right. If so I look at a 21-year-old right today, if I look at a 20-year-old, I don't think they should be driving. Yet I thought I was the saltiest because I went overseas.
Right.
I was been there, done that. I was a hardened Marine.
Right.
That's what I felt like.
At 21.
Yeah.
Yeah.
22. Whatever it was, 21, 22. I was... there's a time period for me where I was not one of those old men in any organization. You guys, your days are gone. I'm still. Somebody, the Marine Corps might just call me. So you sort of don't want to, I did not want to be part of them, because I looked at them when you're, let's face it, just as I look at a 21-year-old, is like, you shouldn't be driving.
He's like, you shouldn't be driving either.
Right. When I look, when you're a 21-year-old, you look at somebody at 25, you're like, dude, you're over the hill. When are you retiring?
Right.
Right. So when you're looking at the people that are part of a VFW post or the Marine Corps League, these are not your, no, I'm not one of them. You just don't realize that you are.
You feel like maybe in a few years, because, I mean, I think one of the things that, I mean, I don't want to give away the piece, Rancidge, but, you know, both you guys talked about coming back, that adjustment, even if, you know, I mean, you saw, you know, the worst that people can throw at each other. And then all of a sudden, boom, you're back in this country. You can go to, you know, Stop and Shop and you know, you can get, you know, anything you want 24 hours a day. I mean, that adjustment's just got to, like, just spin your head around.
Have you seen the movie The Hurt Locker?
Yeah.
So, I forget her name, the director, James Cameron's wife directed that movie, or ex-wife at the time, and she was the first female director to win an Academy Award, which is incredible. So Jeremy Renner comes, he's an EOD guy, explosive ordnance disposal guy, and he comes back, and the scene that I watched that movie, and I was like, oh, this movie's kind of shit, whatever, but he's in the shopping, he's in the supermarket, and he's got choices.
Right.
And he has no idea how to process that, because everything is, and that's when that whole movie became, for me, it came full circle. And I was like, wow, this, how she caught that. What I won't say every soldier, but definitely for me, I would say most soldiers experience coming back. I woke up when I was downrange. I woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning. I ran 5 miles. I went to chow. I had clinic. I took a nap. I went to chow. I worked out. I had clinic. I worked out. Every day was the same. There's no choices in my day. I had no choices. I could sweet and low, equal, regular sugar. What do I do? So that captured the essence of, for me, what it was like coming home and trying to get back into my life. And now put two little kids in there where I was telling you guys before, didn't know who I was when I came home. Yeah. And, you know, and then back into work where when I was downrange, you know, we have soldiers. My population of soldiers is 19 to 25. Those are the guys I'm taking care of. The guys and girls that I'm taking care of. Because now there's women in combat.
Yeah.
So empathy was lost when I came home.
Really?
Because these men and women never, ever wanted to leave the people that they were going on patrol with. I had a guy who had 6 concussions that I had to send home. Because in a way he died, he was crying on my shoulder.
He didn't want to leave.
He didn't want to leave his crew. He was the team leader of his crew. He's like, Doc, I don't care. I can't leave my kid. Then it's on me if I keep him there.
So they've never had a bond with another human being like that.
No, their lives depend on each. So then I come home and here's a 25-year-old guy who hurt his back hammering a nail and he wants me out of work for 3 weeks. Are you kidding me, dude?
Right.
Really? And that's where there was a disconnect for me. I really had a tough time overcoming that, where I was putting guys and girls, I was taking them offline and then putting them back online, and, you know, getting pressure from their commanding officers, from up on high, like colonels and one-star generals saying, Jeff, we need to get this. No, sir. No, he's not. She's not ready to go back. She saw her best friend get blown up in the Humvee next to her. She's done. She can't go back out. She's done. Mentally, she's got to go home. You know, and then I come home to that. And so it took a long time to get that empathy back, to be like, where, okay, you know, it's real. You know, you really, when I came back home and I'm like, well, you know, I hurt. And, you know, it's
so I had to. It makes me wonder. Somebody asked me today, just today, somebody asked me, so you're in the Marines. Does anybody like train you how to cope when you come back? And I said, essentially, my answer is no. Like, why would they? Right? So what? Like, to me, it's just my reality. But you know, when I listen to Warren talk about that, he could say his empathy is returned, but I guarantee there's a small part of him that still filters people with like,
you know, dude, are you kidding me? Right? For the rest of your life.
Well, you've seen, what our soldiers are going through.
People in the most extreme circumstances that human beings can be in. And yeah, the guy who hurt his back hammering a nail, he has not seen that. He's not been that. And I could see from your perspective how you could both have sort of contempt for somebody.
And by the way, don't think that there are not those people in the military.
Yeah, they're 100%. There are those people.
Yeah, of course. To get this back online.
But,
absolutely.
But also, they're everywhere. But also, I detect almost a note of pity that those people will never know what they are capable of or not, that they will never have pushed themselves to that breaking point that you have maybe been to or approached or seen.
I think yes, and I also think it would be the camaraderie and the bond that you develop in a situation like that. It would be cool if everybody could feel it, could experience that. It would change. Good. It would change. I honestly feel, and I'll tell you what, I'll use 9/11. I had the honor mm-hmm. of running a medical clinic in Battery Park after 9/11 and ran medical missions in and out of when it was still being mm-hmm. very recently after, and I saw the best in humanity in Manhattan.
And in New Yorkers.
100%.
And in New Yorkers.
100%. Yeah. People wanted to help out. They would do anything. Yeah. And that was because they held a little, they got for that couple of weeks or months or whatever, mm-hmm. a little flavor of what we get every day in the military.
Mm. So you know, this is totally off subject, but I was down there. I was driving in and out of the site every day. And it was, because I was part of Desert Storm, I saw a piece of this in Desert Storm after it was over. This sort of like welcome home celebrations that were going on. Mm-hmm. But you're on the West Side Highway and there are people, you know, starting a half mile out of the closed zone, standing on the side with signs saying thank you. Thank you to the NYPD. Thank you for all you did. Mm-hmm. They were just...
That's what I did.
Yeah. Like, it was surreal. You know, but that's not the average reception that cops get. But it was, everybody sort of rallied around behind. So in a way, it's sort of what Warren's talking about. That happened with September 11th. Sort of that bonding.
Mm-hmm.
People are in it.
Mm-hmm.
And invested. They feel a piece of it.
Yeah. You're invested in the community, in each other at that, you know, for that. And it would be great if...
If you could do that without being in mortal danger.
Oh, my goodness. Or have a tragedy like 9/11 happen. You know,
yeah.
Just as people, you know.
But that's sort of the thing.
Yeah, it would be really
people
cool.
Don't need each other unless they need each other.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know? And that, you know, and the...
And we're guilty of it. It drives me right up a wall because I'm too much into Facebook and looking at stuff, right? And as a cop.
Mm-hmm.
So... The average, 22 veterans a day, right? Mm. Kill themselves.
Mm.
The average social media warrior will tell you, you could have reached out. And this is for cops too. I can't tell you, I'm inundated by it every day.
Mm.
Reach out. You can talk to me. My number is, you can reach me anytime.
Mm.
I'll do whatever. Why not just reach out? I can't get these people to join the VFW.
Mm.
The way you make that change
mm.
is you give people a home and a society before they ever start feeling maybe this world would be better without me. Mm. Before they ever get there, they could be part of something.
Mm-hmm.
The very people that said, I will be your savior, I cannot get them to join the post. They won't even think of it. Yet that's where they could make the biggest change in their community.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest impact. And they could save lives and not even know it. They won't get to say to their friends the next day, I talked to Jim and he was on the bridge and I talked him off the railing. It won't happen. Jim won't ever drive onto the bridge. Jim will have been part of your chicken barbecue or part of this, this play and felt he was part of something that wasn't just Jim and his lowly life. And twisting off by himself.
Mm.
So it sort of cracks me up. There's this hollowness from support our troops. I've talked to Jeremy about it. People that say, you know, we support our troops. It's one of the most hollow. It means nothing to me, those words.
Nothing. It's great. And maybe out of every 15 people, somebody really means it. I don't know. Maybe I'm really being too cynical. But the vast majority, including veterans, they say it. They sort of like, but I'm busy living my life. You can call me anytime. I'll talk you off that bridge. But hey, I got things going on this weekend. You know what I mean? They don't say that part. They don't follow it up with that. But it is the most... If you're not actually out there doing something, even Jeremy in this case in the play is doing something, in my mind. This play does something. There are so many people busy saying we support our troops, including the troops. And they don't do a damn thing. They're doing nothing. They go back, as I do. So I sort of feel that maybe Warren feels this way too. It does not thrill me to be part of the VFW. I mean, it's not like what I always... Someday I want to be in the VFW. Your mother said
when you were named commander, congratulations, I'm so sorry.
Right. Right. Exactly so my mother's words.
Congratulations, I'm so sorry.
Right. So I didn't grow up wanting to be part of the VFW. Sometimes now with all the challenges, I sort of wish I was, and I wish I could somebody else was doing. But I feel like there's an obligation to carry this on because the VFW does represent something. It does represent the last, you know, bastion of us. The community that you were part of in the military. Because otherwise you just leave. Sort of like leaving the NYPD. You go. When you leave the NYPD and you go upstairs and you get the good guy letter, they call it. The whole time, years, I heard of this good guy letter. And I thought, it's going to say, Brian Williams was a great cop. He made 300 and something arrests. And they retired before ground zero complications, right? So this flowing letter, the good guy letter. Finally, I'm getting one. So I go up. It's the day you turn in your ID card. And you get a retired ID card. Okay, go to the next booth, the next window. It's a half window. You stand there. Okay, what's your tax number? NYPD goes by tax number. What's your tax number? Okay. They hand you out the slip of paper. And on it are like 8 lines. And one is like the firearms division. You know, weapons turned in or accounted for.
It's your exit checkout
supply, right? You know, like whatever you might have had that was department issue, they had radio turned in. It's whatever the lines. Okay, thanks. What is this? It's your good guy letter. What? I thought I was getting this.
An actual letter.
This thing saying I was something, right? I matter. You leave the building with your new, the shield. Warren was a Marine. I was a Marine. Like, in other words, there are certain things that they instilled in me, and maybe just who I am. Boy, that ID card is everything. You will pry that ID card off my body. You will not get it. I will not leave it unattended. I will know where it is at all times. Same thing in the military, or in the NYPD with your shield, an ID card. It's a 10-day hit, vacation hit. If you lose one, I knew somebody. I couldn't imagine. Lost it at a bar. I couldn't imagine. It would never have happened with me. You turn in the shield, which is, it's the Holy Grail. Like, to me, if I left my shield somewhere, the terrorist that was going to take down the world would have that shield and, you know, take down the world. So it is important, right, that I keep this. It's very important. You get done, you're at one of the half windows. Shield. Here it is. They put a little pillow. This is NYPD on it, if you want to take a picture of it. I didn't take a picture.
You put it on a pillow?
Yeah, they put a little pillow like this big. It says, like, New York City Police Department on it. Like, maybe a picture of a police car. You could put it on there and take a picture. I don't know what you want to do with this picture. I didn't take the picture. No. So the pillow's out there. And she, being just a clerk working there, takes
nothing
the...
Nothing clerks, by the way.
What's that?
He wanted to be read as a clerk, man. Come on.
The half window's here. Behind her over here, about 4 feet away, is a cardboard box.
throws your shield in the box. Go to that window, get your good guy letter. Right?
Wow.
That's it. And then you're out. Get your retired ID card. To get in and out of One Police Plaza, you scan your fingerprints in. That's what you do. I go downstairs. When it's all sort of done, it's sort of surreal. It's sort of like the military. I hated leaving, right? I hated leaving there. You go downstairs, there's turnstiles that let you in and out. I go to walk out. I get stopped in the turnstile. I'm like, what is this?
That's how fast it happened. Took your fingerprint out.
The guy over there, did you just retire? Yeah. You doesn't work anymore. You got to go through the civilian gate.
Wow, that quickly.
Wow.
It's over.
You didn't even leave the building.
I didn't leave the building.
And you weren't a cop anymore.
It was over. Okay. You know, I sort of felt, and I think I've told Jeremy this. I have a friend of mine that was in the military, an officer in the military. Mm. And we were talking about the police department. I was talking about the NYPD. And he thought it was a great analogy. I think it's a great analogy, but then again, I think what I say is great, right? So what I said is this. What's crazy is that while you're in the Marine Corps and in the NYPD, mm-hmm. the NYPD would turn me out with a gun, a handgun, handcuffs, and a car. See you later. Go get us something, right? I was in like an active arrest unit, like an activity unit. Go get us something. God, you know, I'm one that thinks about things like, you know, if it weren't for a crime, we're literally kidnapping people off the street. Like, if it weren't for the crime. Like, it's a huge power you have.
Yeah, yeah.
In the Marine Corps, I found myself in situations where it's sort of like the NYPD. You don't know when you show up to work. You show up to work. Suddenly they say, today you're going to do this. And you may be the face of the Marine Corps that day. You don't know it showing up either. Just go. Do what you're doing. Mm. And whatever you do may make the news. So in that way, what I told this friend of mine is sort of like moving the pyramids, that type of stone. We are all just little pipes. If you had to move that big weight from point A to point B, the way to do it is on pipes. And you roll it on those pipes. Each individual little pipe is nothing. We could pick it up and throw it away, but you could move something that weighs however many tons on those pipes. We are each a pipe. Mm. The weight of that organization is on us, and we carry it, and we run it out. But unlike when we're moving a weight from point A to point B, where the pipe comes out the back, you throw it in the front, and we use it again, we just pop out the back. The entire weight of the entire organization was on us. We pop out the back and it's over. It's just left behind. Hmm. And yet we carry the weight of everything on our back. And our story's done. We drift off into nothing. It's sort of surreal. You're sort of gone. Just gone. Sort of like, and the military is that way. When I left the military, for me, I was in Arizona when I was discharged. Here's some money for your moving, whatever, moving van or moving trailer or whatever it is I had. See you later. It's over. There's nobody, your commanding officer's not maybe in war situations. Nobody's calling you to say, great job. There's no good guy letter that comes afterwards. Mm. It's just, it's over.
Or do you think your kids will, are they interested in the military?
So we had, actually my oldest son, as we were talking, I have a senior in high school. Mm-hmm. And I actually offered him a deal for college. His name is Lucas, and I was like, Lucas, if you, and I've never pushed him. So backtrack 30 seconds. I serve in the military, so hopefully my sons don't have to.
Right.
That's my goal. I call it, you know, an ethereal thought or whatever process you want to call it, but I'm kind of paying the dues for my boys so that they never have to. But if they choose to, I will support them in that endeavor. So back to the original story, I made him a deal. I was like, if you go to a school with an ROTC program and you graduate from that school, you have zero debt. I'll write you a check for every cent I've ever saved you for college. So, yeah, but at 17, he's like, I don't know, Army, Marine Corps, whatever. Right. So I don't know. I don't know. You know, like I said, though, I hope they never have to, but if they do, I will support them in their choice.
You can tell me, you know what? You don't have to answer this, obviously. Do they ask you questions?
No.
Right. It's interesting. And it may have nothing to do with relationship to the military. A father who's in the military, it's the nature of fathers and sons. It's like, there's so many questions I've not asked my dad, and the more I think, I'm like, why? Why did I ask him that? Mm. Why? But it's such a...
My dad's a Korean War vet, mm-hmm. and I've never spoken to him about it.
Wow.
Really?
Yeah, and he's never spoken to me about Iraq. Either one of my tours.
Wow.
Ever. And I've been through his jewelry box. I know what he's been awarded. I know what his ribbons are. I know what his combat badges are.
Don't you feel like that's a loss, though?
Yes. And you know, I, Kev, 100% I do. I really do.
So I have something very relevant, I think. NYPD again, but we'll cross into the military. I think it's very relevant. My mother has heard me through it, maybe we're at a wedding, not a wedding probably, but something else, start to tell a story to somebody else about maybe a car chase, something gunpoint or something that happened in the NYPD. And she'll say, why don't you ever tell me these stories? But to me, I know standing, like, once again, we're going back to the kid from Red Hook. When you're standing in your first apartment, listening to some story about whatever it is, with cockroaches falling on your shoulder off the ceiling, and kids running around playing from here, they're playing with cockroaches. They're not playing with cockroaches. They're not even playing with the cockroaches. They're so old hat. They're just playing amongst the cockroaches. I felt like, to me, your family is sort of like, they have no need to know these stories.
Mm.
They don't need to know what Warren's seen. They don't need to know that. I don't want to visit that. I know it, and I don't even want to dwell on it. I would talk to somebody else, maybe Jeremy, if we're out for a drink or something, and if it came up. But my family, I don't want to share that. Mm. Like, that's not... They're supposed to not be part of that.
Mm.
I want to keep them... it's sanitized for them. They don't need to know how low humanity can step. I don't want them to know that. So maybe that's what happens in the case of your father. Like, in other words, I don't know. Like, do you need... you know, there's...
It is easier to talk to a stranger or somebody who isn't close, yes. Definitely.
But if you need to, because part of it is, I think there's a beauty in the fact that, this is what I talked about earlier, there's a beauty in the fact that when I'm in the VFW post, I don't need to talk to people about what they did.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's an incredible beauty about your father not talking to you, and you not talking to him, but you both know everything.
Yes and no. I'll agree to disagree with that. And I won't. My dad's the strongest, you know, to this day, you know, our fathers, you know, you look to your father if you've had a great relationship with your dad. And I was very fortunate to have that with my dad and mom. I still do. That, you know, he's the strongest man in my world. Always has been. Probably always will be. And, you know, I don't want to get into that with him about, I don't know what he saw there. Mm. And, I my dad was not a rifleman. He was not 11 Bravo, which is infantry in the Army. He was not 0311, which is infantry in the Marine Corps. He was an electronics wizard. Basically, he fixed everything, is what he did. My dad was a rocket scientist. He was a lawyer. He's an aerospace engineer. Helped design the LEM, the F-14, like the whole nine yards on Grumman. He's really, really an intelligent guy. And I don't want to... Dad, what happened to you in Korea? Mm-hmm. And I don't want to see that... I don't want to see that chink in the armor if it's there. I want to know my dad as the strongest man I've ever known in my life. Forever in my life.
Yeah.
And if, you know, seeing that... It probably wouldn't, because I know I've experienced it. If he's experienced it, and I don't know what he's done, but it doesn't matter to me.
Mm.
You know, he came home and he's the best father I could ever
ask. Your dad. He's your dad.
Regardless of what he saw or did in Korea.
Mm.